You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rockland, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio and also streaming live on Instagram. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rockland, and I am here to help you break free from body shame, binging, and diets that don't work. I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. And if you would like to join me today, if you have any questions, please give me a call. The call-in number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. I would love to hear what is on your mind, what is weighing on you, because the real problem with binge eating, stress eating, any kind of emotional eating, the real problem is not food. The real problem is what's eating at you. And that is why the title of the TED Talk I just did, TEDx Talk I just did on Sunday in Santa Barbara, thank you, UCSB TEDx guys. You organized an amazing event. The title of my talk was Why Binging Isn't Really About Food. Doesn't make sense, right? At first, but no, it's not about food. It is not what you are eating that is the real problem. It's what's eating at you. Binge eating, emotional eating, any kind of problematic relationship with food is a solution to the problem. It is not the problem, but it seems like the problem, of course. So the goal is to get to, well, what is the problem and find new ways of healing that, whether that is a difficulty identifying what you're even feeling or thinking, or maybe you know what you're feeling or thinking, and there's parts of it that are hidden that you don't know that you need to take a look at, or you know what it is, but you don't know how to be with yourself, comfort yourself, respond to yourself. You know, when we don't know how to be with ourselves, comfort ourselves, express ourselves, or respond to ourselves, of course, no wonder so many of us eat to cope. But the good news is that when you find new ways of coping, everything changes for good. And it really is possible. That is what I do with my patients and my clients all over the world, is help them find a new way to relate to themselves. Because when we relate differently with ourselves, when we make peace with ourselves, we make peace with food too. What do I mean by make peace with ourselves? It means identifying why we're eating instead of focusing on what we're eating. It means accepting ourselves and expressing ourselves, accepting our emotions, expressing our emotions. It means like accepting our idiosyncrasies, our weirdness, our wonderfulness, right? Makes life interesting, makes us interesting. And also being nice to ourselves, encouraging ourselves, supporting ourselves. When we do that, we break free from binge eating, because thoughts and ideas lead to feelings, lead to behavior. So if you're only focusing on the behavior, guess what? It's like plucking a weed and thinking, oh, I plucked this weed. It's not going to grow back. Of course it's going to grow back. It always grows back. That is because there is a root that is creating that weed. We can't see it. That's why I like this analogy particularly, because it's very analogous to our unconscious minds. There are aspects that are hidden from us. We can't know it. We don't discern it. We don't see it. But it is absolutely the cause of so much of what we are doing. But when we do some emotional gardening and dig out that root, then everything changes. And then you don't have to keep plucking weeds again and again and again. And what are plucking weeds? It's going on diet after diet after diet after diet. So when we really get to the root of why we're turning to food instead of focusing on what we are eating, and when we find new ways of responding to ourselves, everything changes for good. For good. And I say this not only as a psychoanalyst with 20 years of experience treating eating disorders, primarily binge eating, but also as someone who was the poster child for eating disorders back in the day. And I, as some of you know, I broke free from being the poster child of eating for eating disorders without ever talking about food to my therapist. I not once, not a single time, never ever did I talk to my therapist about what was going on with food. But when I left treatment, all my eating disorders were gone for good. And how is that possible? Because I changed my relationship to myself. I turned my inner critic into a friend. And when we do that, so much changes. Oh, thank you so much, Barbara, for the congratulations. Oh, I really appreciate that. That's really kind. I was so grateful to be able to do that because to do this TEDx talk because so many people are struggling. So many people think, oh, I have no control. Oh, I have no willpower. I'm addicted to sugar. And they're wrong. It's not about control. It's not about willpower. You're not addicted to sugar. It's about something deeper and more powerful and more profound. And when we change our relationship with ourselves, everything else changes. And this is a message that more people need to hear. And by the way, one of the things that I say actually in my talk is I go through a lot about my food mood formula, which helps you identify the hidden reasons you're binging because, you know, we get so good at turning to food, we don't even know we're being triggered by something situational. We don't even know what we're feeling. So my food mood formula definitely helps you figure that out. So I go through my food mood formula and a lot about my story. And by the way, if you don't have the food mood formula, go to my website, drninainc.com, drninainc.com, and you can sign up for it there. But after I talk about a lot of this stuff, dealing with food and unconscious motivations for eating and how you discern that, then I tell people, look, food is not even the real problem. Well, let's talk about the real problem, which is that we live in a society that says it is not okay to have feelings. We're considered weak if we have feelings and strong if we push them away. So if you're scared, it's like, hey, be strong, fight, don't give in to fear. If you're angry, oh, you're an angry person. That's right, Barb, not about the food. No, it's not what you're eating that's the problem. It's what's eating at you. We're told, oh, you're an angry person. Get anger management classes. You can't be angry. If you're sad, you're depressed. You got to take an antidepressant stat. If you're anxious, there is also a pill for that too. So no wonder so many of us, you know, don't know what to do with our feelings. And by the way, of course, some of us benefit from medication. But I am talking about injunctions against our basic human emotions that connect us to ourselves and to each other. And with all these prohibitions against just experiencing our emotions, which are reactions to situations, with all these prohibitions, it is no wonder so many of us don't know how to be with ourselves or express ourselves or comfort ourselves or respond to ourselves. So no wonder so many of us turn to food. Barb is saying, yeah, put yourself together. Put yourself together. Be strong. No, no. Feelings are simply reactions to situations. They are not character flaws. And when we can be interested in our feelings, when we can say, okay, what am I feeling and why? And how would I treat anybody else who was feeling sad? I mean, hopefully you wouldn't say to a child or someone you care about, put yourself together, be strong, stop it, quit that. Quit it, stop it. Hopefully you'd say, oh, what are you feeling? What's going on? I'm here for you. The goal is to be that way to ourselves, right? When we're helpful and interested and supportive to ourselves. Oh, hi, Valentin. My French teacher is here. Dans la maison. Don't take that as any kind of don't take my accent as any kind of meaning of his lessons. He's a great teacher, Valentin Clerc. If you need French lessons, you got to check out Monsieur Valentin Clerc. So, hi Valentin. I'll get better, I promise. Yes, so people have options. We're supposed to be strong, be tough, you know, deny it, push it down, push it away, drop it. Oh, positive think it away. By the way, how do we positive think away a feeling? You cannot positive think away a feeling. That's called being dismissive. That's toxic positivity. You know, something bad happens and you're like, oh, but look on the bright side. Here's all the reasons why you should feel good about the thing that happened instead of bad about it. That's actually diminishing and denying your reality. Josh, I did my TEDx talk on Sunday. It is not on YouTube yet because it is being edited. There were 8 speakers at this incredible event that UCSB put on. And all 8 of those speeches are going to be edited professional thing. Believe me, I will let you know. I will let you guys know when you can find it on YouTube because I will be sharing the heck out of that video. I want as many people to see it as possible because it is so important that we change the conversation in our society and stop feeling bad about ourselves because we feel helpless and powerless over food. The reality is, even if you do feel helpless and powerless over food, you can figure out a new way of responding to yourself and start eating normally. You know, it really is possible. And as you guys know, it is possible. And Barb, I will absolutely let you know. And thank you for sharing it even more. I appreciate that. So more than one someone wrote and said that they really liked the vignettes that I shared from my book last week, Beyond the Primal Addiction, in which I talk about, like, ironically, the chapter is called Food Addiction, but I don't believe in food addiction. It was an ironically titled chapter. Unless we're talking possibly about an eating addiction. An eating addiction, which I don't like the word addiction because it is so pejorative and shaming. But an eating addiction is an addiction to using eating as a way to resolve, escape, comfort yourself. Whereas a food addiction is the idea that you're actually physiologically addicted to the substance of food. So if we're going to use the word addiction, you know, maybe eating addiction, but let's not even use the word addiction. So it's highly ironic that my book was called Beyond the Primal Addiction. But the only reason for that was a phrase that Freud once used. So, okay. So a couple people asked me if I would share another vignette from the book. Josh, did I learn anything from my experience? I learned that there are a lot of people doing a lot of amazing things and trying to make the world a better place. And I met some of them on Sunday from all parts of the country. A lot of people have a lot of interesting things to say. And so many people are committed to actually changing the world, changing the conversation, creating harmony with ourselves, between ourselves. And that's just a beautiful, heartening thing to see, that there are so many people who are actively trying to change the world. And by the way, I will share, for those of you who are here a lot, you know Carly Gash and Josh are frequent callers, and Carly Gash came to the talk. So I was able to see Carly Gash, which was really a great treat. I am going to share this story of Marta, not her real name. It's interesting. I thought it was interesting. It ended up in the book. I hope you'll find it interesting too. So she sought treatment because nearly every night she ate a family-sized bag of potato chips. like potato chips, Doritos, popcorn. She cycled through. Those were her choices. Like she would eat just huge quantities of chips or something crunchy. And she felt completely out of control when it came to chips. Yet after a few weeks of therapy, this is gonna sound very self-aggrandizing, but keep listening because you'll see. At first, it sounds like I'm bragging, but no, that's not at all what's happening. Just keep listening. So after a few weeks of therapy, she reported she was not eating chips every night. She was also a model patient. She showed up on time to every session. She worked really hard to make sense of the concepts we discussed. She read about psychoanalytic principles. She diligently tracked her dreams, her emotions, her thoughts, her interactions with others. Several months into her treatment, I went on vacation for a week. When I got back, Marta shared that she'd been upset with me for leaving. And then immediately she assured me that she was not actually angry with me. It was just the transference talking, whatever that meant. So Marta reminded me of a student trying to please a teacher instead of a patient or client undergoing analysis. Oh, side note, why do I say patient? So I was trained in the medical model, right? And patients, the definition of a patient is someone who is suffering. And my job is to help alleviate suffering. And that is why psychoanalysts often use the word patient, because it really shows how you're there to help alleviate suffering, whereas client sounds more transactional. But whatever, it's semantics. I use patient in here, so that's why I'm saying patient. So she reminded me of a student trying to please a teacher. I was the teacher, she was the student. Her parents had been authoritarian and inflexible. They insisted they knew what was best for their children, and they demanded compliance to what they wanted rather than showing interest in their children's emotions and thoughts. Marta learned that acquiescence, just give in, was the key to relational harmony. Hey, if you just give in to someone, everything's gonna be good. Only by trying to figure out what her parents wanted and then submitting to those wants could she assure herself that they would accept her. So, unbeknownst to herself, Marta was absolutely repeating that dynamic with me. It seemed like she was trying to please me instead of using our sessions to better understand herself. She also did not put herself in a position of vulnerability ever. So outwardly, she appeared to depend on me, and she'd tell me she was depending on me, and she'd say a lot of stuff like that. But actually, she was doing all the thinking and interpreting herself, excluding me in the process. So she reported on her thoughts instead of talking about her feelings. Big, big, big difference, right? This is what I'm thinking up here in my head, in my thoughts. And she never got to what she felt. So she began to lose weight. Like she really began to lose weight. She lost 80 pounds in nearly 6 months. And she considered this a total miracle. And she attributed her success to me. She'd say, oh, you're amazing, Dr. Nina. Nobody else has been able to help me until now. I'm so glad I found you. Okay. So guess what? This did not make me feel good. I started getting uneasy with what I considered sort of an idealization. And I was also uneasy with this really fast weight loss. When I suggested that she was relating to me as she had related to her parents and losing weight to please me, she totally disagreed. She was like, no, you are nothing like them. And she's like, and we were almost the same age too. She's like, we're the same age. You're not my mother, whatever. And I interpreted that her relentlessly positive attitude towards me, idealization, might be hiding some other emotions. And I normalized these other emotions. I normalized anger, hostility, jealousy, whatever, resentment. I told her, like, maybe you were upset that I went on vacation. It's okay to be upset. You can share that with me. That wasn't the transference talking. I don't even know what that means in that situation. Like it's okay to have feelings towards me that aren't all, you know, unicorns and puppies and Disneyland. And I invited Marta to share her feelings, but she resisted. She resisted the idea that her favorable feelings and thoughts towards me were actually idealization, and she held on to the position that her positive feelings towards me were simply that, positive feelings. She said, even Freud said sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, which is a famous quote attributed to Freud. I actually don't know if it's true or not, but apparently his daughter went to him and said, oh, Papa, I've had this dream, and I was in a train going through tunnel after tunnel after tunnel in this big, strong train, and then there was a man smoking a cigar. So it was all this like phallic sexual imagery, really super obvious. It was his daughter talking, right? And so supposedly Freud said, oh, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar and not a phallic object. Okay. In other words, Marta was like, no. No, it's not what you're saying. It's not any of that. I really do like you. You really are helping me. Blah, blah, blah. So shortly after she reached her goal weight, check this out, Marta began to binge again. At each session, she appeared to be visibly bigger. She was gaining weight in front of my eyes. She was no longer eating potato chips, but instead was, as she put it, really into chocolate. I began to sense like a deep sense of helplessness watching her gain weight at this really fast pace. And she would say, oh, she did not have any control. She blamed herself. She said, oh, I'm just a hopeless case, she said. Her words were very self-deprecating. Her manner was very sorrowful. And yet, I wanted to shake her for gaining this weight back. I'm being very obvious and blunt about my counter transference, which is the feeling that a therapist has in session. I wanted to shake her for gaining weight, for rejecting our work together. I was frustrated with her because she resisted the development of any true, meaningful connection between us. It was all very intellectual and heady. And I believed that Marta's ballooning weight was expressing what her mind could not. She was angry at me since I represented an authority figure, even though we were just about the same age. I represented an authority figure, i.e. her parents, and she was rebelling against my perceived authority over her. She was an overly obedient child, and she never rebelled or differentiated herself from her parents. So now, by gaining weight, she was actively rebelling. She was also unconsciously, unbeknownst to her, she was creating in me, this is the interesting part, she was creating in me the same feelings of helplessness and anger that had marked nearly every day of her childhood with her parents. So now, she kind of turned the table. So I was the helpless child. Basically, I was the helpless one as she had been the helpless one with her parents. Now I was the helpless one with her, unable to stop her from gaining more and more and more and more weight. And when she complained about gaining weight again, I decided that I was going to be more transparent about my thoughts, my countertransference. I told her I believed she was unconsciously letting me know what she had felt as a child, submitting to the expectations of her parents. So at the beginning of our work together, she had related to me as she had to her parents. She was compliant. She did what she thought I wanted her to do. She was losing weight. She thought I wanted her to lose weight. So she lost weight. She would do everything like a good little girl. It was as if she did it for me rather than for herself. Now, by gaining weight, she left me unable to help her. She had effectively reversed roles, unconsciously making me the helpless, angry, helpless one. I not only intellectually understood what she had gone through as a child, I now had a visceral sense of her experience because I felt that helplessness. So I told her this, and several minutes of silence followed. I had no idea what she was thinking or feeling. And she left the session without saying another word. Total silence for like 7 minutes. And she just got up and left it was at the end of our time, but she got up and left, didn't say anything. She left me hanging, which is how it felt to me. And at the next session, so she was an analytic patient, which meant she lay down on the couch. She came multiple times a week. She lay down on the couch, so we didn't have eye contact. But at the next session, she did not lie down. She faced me. She sat up on the couch, and she faced me instead of lying down. And very slowly and very deliberately, she took a Toblerone chocolate bar out of her purse, a giant one, and unwrapped it. And she looked at me like she was daring me to react. And I just looked at her as neutrally as I could, but as warmly. And then she put the chocolate bar on the table between us as if she were throwing it down like a gauntlet. And I thought about it for a moment. I looked at her. She was watching me very, very intently. And I looked at her and I said, "That looks yummy." And she was just like totally startled. And she said, "You really don't care if I eat this?" And this question was like a first recognition on her part that something was playing out between us. We needed to understand the dynamic between us and that she could have a different experience with me than she had had with her parents and that she had with herself, because she was always trying to be good, eat the right thing, don't eat the right thing, do the right exercise, all of that. And we started about how, and thus began like our first actual relating. And when she was able to use words to express her anger at feeling controlled by her parents, or her sense of rejection and anger when I left on vacation, and when she could talk about wanting to rebel against restrictions, she stopped using food and her body to express those conflicts and wishes. So, I hope that you find that as interesting as I did, as it really shows how we are often unconsciously using food and weight and behavior as a way of expressing something, right? She couldn't rebel. The only way she could rebel was by gaining weight, doing the opposite thing that she thought that I wanted. So yes, she was acting against her own best interests, but she was doing so for a reason, and she was rebelling against me because she couldn't rebel against her parents. So that's why you have often heard me say, be curious, not critical. If you are eating something you don't want to eat, if you are doing something you don't want to do, or if you're not doing something you want to do, there is always, always, always a reason. And when you are curious, and you try to figure out, well, what is that reason? You are more likely to figure out what it is, right? Instead of, I can't believe I did that. I can't believe I ate that. Well, why did I eat that? What purpose did that serve for me? And it's not always so intense as, something like with Marta, what I just described. But there is always a reason. And that reason may be hidden from you, but the more you are a detective of your mind instead of a critic, the more likely you are to discover the reasons for why you're turning to food instead of focusing on food itself. Make sense? Any questions? Again, if you would like to join me, the number is 323-203-0815, 323-203-0815. feel free to share whatever is going on with you in your, with your life, with food, anything that's going on, because people will often say, well, I want to talk to you, but it doesn't have to do with food. Like, is it eating at you? Then it needs your attention. So, and if you're on Instagram, feel free to drop a comment. And yes, I considered myself a detective of the mind, right? Because detectives look for reasons to solve the mystery. They look for clues. And when detectives look for clues, when I tell my patients and clients, hey, we're detectives. We're going to solve the mystery of why you are eating that when you don't want to eat that, or why you can't let yourself lose weight, or why you have a better relationship with food than with people, or why you feel a sense of helplessness and you have no willpower over sugar, whatever it is. We're detectives. Detectives don't judge clues. They don't go, oh, thanks, Barb. She said, you are the best detective. That's so sweet. I read a lot of Agatha Christie and old school detectives. I grew up on Nancy Drew. Detectives have been a part of my life since I was a little kid. Reading. It was always detective stories. So detectives don't say, that's a weird clue. Oh, that's a bad clue. Oh, I can't believe that clue. That's a terrible clue. No. Detectives say, okay, that's interesting. Okay, now we know more. Now we have more information. So be a detective of your own mind and figure out what it is that is going on with you. If you are turning to food, you are doing so for a reason. You are turning away from something else. You are giving yourself comfort or distraction. There is always a reason. Okay. One of the things that I'm also asked is, oh, you're a psychoanalyst. Why is it always about the past? It's always about the past. Why? Why can't we just be in the present? Because we're not actually in the present without the past. We are haunted by the past. And the goal of therapy is actually to put the ghosts of the past back into the past, make them stop haunting us, turn them into ancestors, put them in the ground. We ghosts haunt us. Ancestors are in the ground or in an urn or somewhere. They don't bother us. Ghosts are constantly with us. And so recognizing how the past has affected our present and what is going on with us now that has its roots in the past is essential and part of our detective work. So our past can be a powerful influence on our present feelings and food habits. For many of us, our first experience of love and comfort is being fed in our parents' arms. The desire to reconnect to this time of love and safety and bliss when all is well with the world, that can make us turn to food in difficult times. The truth is that people can disappoint us, hurt us, leave us, and make us angry. Unlike people, food is reliable, right? Food is reliable, predictable, and available. It is always what it is. Like, you're not going to have a bite of chocolate cake and have it taste like, I don't know, a caterpillar. That's a weird analogy, but have it taste like pizza. Like, it is what it is. It's not going to change on you. It is reliable and it is available. Unlike people, you know, if you're lonely or if you're looking for a substantive relationship where you want to feel connected to people, but you can't, or it's the middle of the night and there's no one you can really call, then food, which represents people in our psyche, is a good substitute. So it can be easy to fall into a routine of soothing ourselves with food when what we really need is comfort, love, and support from another person or from ourselves or both. And often we have experiences in our past that lead us to feel not good enough, And those feelings of inadequacy can lead us to try to fill that emptiness with food. You know, if you feel empty, if you feel lonely, if you feel disconnected, that feeling is like a hole in our life, a hole in our soul. It's like an empty space. And we can sometimes symbolically fill it with food. So instead of feeling the emptiness, the emotional emptiness, we have this feeling of being full, which temporarily, you know, escapes that empty feeling. So if you were given food when you were upset as a child, you likely carried this pattern into adulthood. I mean, there are people who, and I have observed this at the park. My kids are older, so I don't go to the park so much anymore, but I used to go to the park and like there'd be, often it was nannies, there'd be like a baby or little kid and they'd cry and boop, they just pop a bottle of milk into their mouth. They didn't try to decide like, okay, what does this baby need? Does this baby need a hug, or is she hungry, or does she need her diaper changed, or is something else going on? Is she uncomfortable? It was just like, oh, whatever it is that's wrong, here's a bottle of milk to shut you up. Well, if you are that baby, then what do you learn? That any feeling of discomfort, anytime you are uncomfortable, food is the solution. And that is why we often see people who are, they're tired, but they eat food to wake themselves up, or well, for whatever reason, maybe not even consciously aware of what they're doing. Or they're lonely and they fill themselves up, or they're angry and they eat food to calm themselves down, right? So, you know, if food is the answer to everything, then we actually don't cultivate the ability to respond to ourselves in a healthy way. So childhood experiences affect how you relate to yourself and the world. So if your parent had a negative response to your feelings, it would cause you to dismiss your emotions instead of comfort them. And then you end up eating for comfort. So remember, why food? A lot of people say, well, why food? Why is food my thing? They often say, why am I addicted to food? But why is food my thing? And it's just what I was talking about before. Our first experience of being fed is connected with the experience of being held and often, you know, smiled at and connected to. So eating and connection are fused. Not that we consciously think of it that way, but it's in our culture. We talk about comfort food. What is comfort food? It is actually a wish to be comforted. We talk about being hungry for love, starving for attention, right? We use food words to describe both our hunger for connection and our hunger for actual food. Satisfying relationships. Oh, that meal was satisfying. So a lot of the same language is used. So if you are lonely, you may not be able to find someone to talk to, or who will comfort yourself, or comfort you, or who will even give you the response you need. Because sometimes when we feel something and we go to someone, they're trying to be nice and they're trying to be helpful, but they end up being dismissive. Oh, you're okay. It's going to be fine. You're good. You're good. It's all good. Everything happens for a reason. You know, that's just not helpful. What we really need to hear is that sucks. That's terrible. We need validation from others, and we need to give it to ourselves. So if something happens that upsets you and you go to someone and you say, I'm so upset. I didn't pass the bar exam. And someone says, oh, you'll do it next time. You've got this. You'll get it next time. You know, so many people didn't pass it the first time. Like, you're in good company. You got it. Okay, that's encouraging. But, you know, it doesn't speak to how you feel. So if you go to someone and say, oh, I feel so terrible about myself because I didn't pass the bar exam, I'm so disheartened, and they tell you why you're going to pass it in the future, what about your feelings in the present? Actually, the way to deal with that so that you don't eat over it is to say, well, if you know someone who didn't pass the bar exam, you say to them, that sucks. That is really disappointing. That is so painful and upsetting. I am so sorry. That's horrible. How devastating. How difficult, right? You're validating and acknowledging what they are feeling. And you could do this to yourself too. If you are having an issue and you tell yourself, oh, look on the bright side, it'll be better. I'm going to be better. Like, you give yourself a pep talk. It won't work because you haven't validated how you feel. So there's nothing wrong with the pep talk, but before you give the pep talk to yourself, tell yourself how awful the situation is, right? This is hard. This is devastating. This is painful. This is super upsetting. Of course I feel this way. And then you can give yourself the pep talk, right? Because if not, you have all these feelings that are going kind of unresolved. And then what happens? If you don't know how to respond to your feelings and in a way that is actually soothing and comforting, you might eat for comfort. That is why being able to relate differently with ourselves is so important. How much time do I have? Okay. I'm going to talk about Zoe. So this is now from another book. This is from The Binge Cure. So let's say, you recognize, hey, people are not all bad. I can trust people, blah, 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 blah. You know it intellectually, but it hasn't quite synced with how you feel. So that was the case with Zoe. She wanted to join my weekly eating disorder support group, but something always came up and she never actually made it to the group. And she finally confessed that she was afraid she would be, in her words, the fattest one in the room, which was so painful for me to hear when she said that. This fear also affected her personal life. She wouldn't meet friends in restaurants because she was afraid she'd be the, quote, fattest one there, unquote. She didn't want to go to the gym for the same reason. She lamented her lack of willpower. She thought her body was disgusting and gross. She was so concerned that she'd be the biggest one in the room that she stayed home. And when Zoe was home, she ate. Whether or not Zoe would have been, in fact, the biggest person in any room was irrelevant. Lots of people feel that way, whether they weigh 400 pounds or 140. Your actual weight doesn't even matter. You can feel big, even if you're not. So I asked Zoe what would happen if she actually were the biggest person in the room, whether it was my support group, the gym, the office, a restaurant, a party, or anywhere else. What then? What did she imagine people were thinking about her? She said, well, they think I have no willpower. They think I'm disgusting. They think I'm gross. I didn't want anything to do with me, people would think. Well, if you notice that was almost word for word what Zoe herself said about herself, then you're right. She assumed people were thinking the very same harsh thoughts that she did. Without realizing it, she was projecting her own thoughts onto others and then directing it back at herself. Most of us are not psychic. We don't actually know what is going on in the minds of others. But if you think that other people are thinking the most awful, critical, and judgmental thoughts possible, think about the way you relate with yourself. Consider whether the thoughts you imagine other people have about you are the same thoughts you have about yourself. Zoe realized she was afraid of someone, something else. If she were the biggest one, she thought the others, and she didn't want to feel inferior to them. So why would she think that? Well, this fear went all the way back to her childhood when she and her siblings were always trying to outdo each other. They competed for who got the best grades, who could eat ice cream the slowest, who could stay up the latest, and more. I mean, they had all these weird competitions about things that you wouldn't think would be competitions. So not only did Zoe think the group would judge her weight, she also imagined that the group members would relate to her the way her siblings related to her in the past. And she didn't want to experience that kind of rivalry. Her original group was her and her siblings. So whenever she was with a group, she imagined it would be just like the original group and everyone would be like vying for a position in some way. So she needed to develop an invisible mental shield, kind of like a Star Wars deflector shield. I gotta get my Star Wars in at least once a radio show, right? So we created what she called emotional Teflon by considering alternative scenarios to the one she had in her head. She visualized the group welcoming her, relating to her, making her feel understood, listening to her. She imagined people at the gym looking at her and thinking, good for her, getting healthy, good for her. I have a friend from Texas who likes to say, go big or go home. When you're visualizing something new and pleasant, that is the time to go big, to be an emotional heavyweight, to be the person with the biggest self-confidence, the largest sense of self. So how do we do this? We consider what aspects of yourself, and by the way, yourself is not just your body. Consider what parts of yourself, physical, intellectual, mental, emotional, creative, relational, what parts do you feel good about right now, today, at this stage of your life? Remember that the number on the bathroom scale doesn't define you. The scale measures only your weight, not your value as a person. Keep in mind that the size of your kindness, generosity, intelligence, and compassion is a far better measure of your worth. So if other people don't see past the number on the scale, then you got their number, so to speak. And guess what? You can delete it. When you feel good about yourself, your whole self, you're far less likely to turn to food for comfort or distraction because you don't need distraction from happiness and self-acceptance. And when you feel good about your whole self, feeling bad about your weight, I'm in no way suggesting that you're going to be like, oh, my weight, whatever. Like, if you want to lose weight, I'm not saying that you're just going to be like, whatever, I don't care about that anymore. What I'm saying is that you'll care less because you, instead of that being the whole predictor of your future and your lovability and your likability and your good enoughness, it'll just be something that you want to change about your body, not your whole self-esteem is based on that. Because when we like ourselves and we take care of ourselves as if we're people we actually like, we feel better about ourselves. We don't need food to escape. You cannot tear yourself down, be mean to yourself, and simultaneously lift yourself up and support yourself. You cannot be mean to yourself and sweet to yourself at the same time. It doesn't work that way. So what happens when we're mean to ourselves, we feel bad. And then instead, because you can't be mean and sweet to yourself, the sweetness comes from sweets often. That is why changing the way we think about how we are in the world, how we relate to ourselves, how we relate with other people, has everything to do with changing what happens with food. Really briefly, I once treated a singer who had terrible stage fright, and she would think that everyone was looking at her, thinking all kinds of judgmental, horrible things. Oh my God, she doesn't sound very good. She's so big. She's gained weight. All these terrible things that were all her thoughts about herself. And as we worked together and she changed the way she thought about herself, and she was not judgmental. She was supportive. She was encouraging. She could express herself. She actually went on tour. And she called me from tour and she said, oh my God, I think other people, like a whole new bunch of people have discovered me. I think like I have a whole new audience. No, she did not have the whole new audience. She had the same people coming to see her, only instead of her projecting her own negative self-talk and negative judgmental thoughts into the audience and back at her, Now she was projecting her own positive self-worthy thoughts into the audience and back at her. And that is why our relationship with ourselves has everything to do with all our relationships with other people and with food. That is my show for today. Thank you so much for joining me here on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio. You can listen live every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, and you can also listen later at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts. If you like the show, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave me a rating or a review or both for the show, because the more ratings and reviews that I get, the more it shows up in searches, the more people I can help. And that's what this is all about. So the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio is the whole name of it on Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much. Stay curious, not critical. And I'll see you next week. Bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.